All right, and now to introduce tonight's speaker, please welcome Diane.
Hi, my name is Diane and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I think I forgot what I was going to say. I'd like to introduce a very special lady to come up and speak tonight and share her experience, strength, and hope with everybody. And here's Ruthie.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Ruth, and I am an alcoholic.
Oh, that's probably a good idea.
I want to thank Bill for asking me to come out here tonight and share my experience, strength, and hope. And if nothing else, give me an opportunity to participate in my own recovery. Because I know by doing this, I get to stay sober. I have a sobriety date. It's September 18th, 1986. I have a sponsor. I have a home group. It's the Tuesday Women's Amity Group. I sponsor women in this program, and I have service commitments, and that's the basis of what I do to stay sober. I grew up in a relatively normal home, I guess. It was just my sister and I. There was no real big secrets in the family or what was going on behind closed doors. It was just that, you know, there was dysfunction, but as long as everybody looked okay on the outside and as long as everybody went to church on Sundays and, you know, as long as our hair was washed and our faces were clean, we were normal, you know, and everything was okay. But, you know, there was something I did not feel okay inside. I did not feel like I belonged anywhere. And I remember that from the beginning. I remember that feeling of not feeling like I belonged. Not even in my own family. There was some drinking that went on in our house and not anything that I remember being particularly over the top. My parents did provide me with alcohol from time to time before the time I turned 16. You know, family functions, New Year's Eve, a glass of champagne here and there, you know, nothing big. Not anything to get drunk over. When I was 16 years old, that's when I remember taking the first drink. I was in an uncomfortable environment, and the first time that time that I drank at 16, I remember thinking, this is the answer I've been searching for. This is what makes me feel okay inside, no matter what's going on outside. And I've never really felt that before. And I was 16 years old. I was working in a bar and a restaurant. I was cleaning the bar at the time. It was my job on Saturday and Sunday mornings to clean the bar. And I was relatively new at this job, and I had to wash all the glasses and wipe down all the surfaces and disinfect everything, you know. And the boss came in, and it was just him and I. And he said, have they taught you how to pour a beer yet? And I'm like, no. So he proceeded to show me how to pour a beer. He poured one, he told me to wash, I washed it. And then he said, okay, now you do it. And I washed it, and I did it. And he said, well, you need a little practice, but you'll have time for that. So here we are standing here with two glasses of beer. I've got one in my hand, he's got one in his hand. And he says to me, well, you know what they say about alcoholics, don't you? And I said, no. And he said, well, an alcoholic is someone who drinks alone. I am not an alcoholic, so drink up. So I took that drink. And that was the drink. That was the drink that I don't think I ever crossed the line, but that was the drink that I took that one time where I thought, this is the answer I have been looking for. I felt that sense of ease and comfort. And I felt that just sense that everything was okay, not only outside, but in here. And that was a feeling I very rarely got. And it was a feeling that I chased for the next 5 years through my drinking, but never quite got to the same level as that night, as that one morning when I took that drink. So I started drinking. Drinking was not very hard, as you can imagine, since my boss was giving me beer without me even asking for it. Alcohol was not very hard for me to get a hold of. And I started drinking alcoholically from that day forward. I was a blackout drinker. I threw up. And I couldn't wait to get that feeling again. And this went on for a couple of years, and I turned 18, and I was in Wisconsin at the time, and the drinking age in Wisconsin was 18, and all of a sudden, I didn't even have to try to find a way to get alcohol. And that's when my drinking really took off. I was a senior in high school. I could legally drink by the time I was before I graduated from high school, I could legally drink. And when I did graduate from high school, that's when I stopped having any. Up until that point, I at least had some respect for my mother's rules, my father's rules. I had some respect for the fact that I was living in their home. But when I turned 18 and I graduated from high school, that's when all that respect flew out the window. And I cannot tell you the number of times that I would go out drinking, not bother to call, not bother to come home until like 8 o'clock in the morning. And there'd be my mom dressed, ready to go to work. Her eyes were swollen from crying and lack of sleep. And as soon as she knew I was okay, she'd go to work. And you know, I had no regard for that. I mean, it didn't really, I knew that that was not okay, but I really didn't feel that there was anything I could do about it. On my 18th birthday, my mom sat me down, and she was already concerned about my drinking, and she told me a story about something that had happened to her sister after a night of drinking. And long story short, my aunt had been raped one night after a night of drinking, and she became pregnant, and the first skeleton out of my closet came out. It was my cousin wasn't really, you know, my cousin was a product of rape. And my mom told me that, and you know, the only reason I repeat that story is because that was that. I don't know, for those of you that have read Bill's story, you hear there's a phrase in Bill's story, ominous warning which I failed to heed. And that day, the day I turned 18, was my ominous warning which I failed to heed. When I was drinking, I had no control over where I was going to end up, who I was going to end up with, and what was going to happen to me. And the catalyst to the last year and a half of my worst alcohol drinking was that very same thing. I was drunk in a bar. I ended up somewhere where I had no business being, and somebody also raped me. I did not become pregnant, but I did go through that, and it was just crystal clear that my alcoholism was up. That my life was spinning out of control, but I didn't know what else to do about it because this alcohol that was causing so much problems for me was my answer to all my life's problems. So I had this dilemma, you know, I mean, I can't quit drinking. This is what makes me feel okay. Even though it wasn't making me feel okay, I just, not by that point. So, you know, I went through all that and I continued to drink, and I was 21 years old, and I went through a court case, and that was pitiful. That wasn't even enough pitiful and comprehensible demoralization for me to have to go up there on a stand and testify against this guy and have my mom sitting there, my mom that had already just, you know, totally hurt beyond any, beyond what I thought I was ever capable of hurting her. I hurt her. And she had to listen to me tell all this, and I mean, she chose to do this stuff, and that wasn't even enough for me. I continued to drink, probably just to make that all go away. I don't know. But anyway, about a year and a half later, one night I was out drinking, and I wasn't getting my way, and I was with a boyfriend who, you know, I mean, I guess he was more like a hostage than a boyfriend at that point, but it was a real mess, and it was the night of my last drunk. It was probably about September, I don't know, 14th, something like that. And he was mad at me, I was mad at him, and we were driving home, and he was driving, and I just didn't know what else to do. I was just, like, crawling out of my skin, and I was so unhappy, and like something was wrong, but I couldn't put my finger on it and whatever, and I tried to steer the car that he was driving off the cliff, and he ended up having enough control over the car that the car did not go over the edge. But he didn't know what to do with me, so he took me to the emergency room of the local hospital. And they didn't know what to do with me, so they took me by ambulance to the hospital in my hometown, which, one more time, my poor mother, she worked at the clinic that was affiliated with that hospital, and they locked me up in a psych ward that night. So my mom found me at the hospital where she works the next day, and here is probably the last of my pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization as far as while I was drinking is concerned. I was in the psych ward of the hospital, it was a week before my sister's wedding, and I really didn't know what was going on, and I was supposed to be in town anyway, but I happened to be hospitalized, so hey, I'm in town after all. And they brought the dress that I was supposed to wear to my sister's wedding for a final fitting in the psych ward of the hospital. So anyway, I spent a couple of days in the hospital, and I got out, and I was really pretty much convinced that I needed to quit drinking. I didn't know how I was going to quit drinking, but I knew I couldn't keep drinking. I knew I wanted to survive. And but God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. About 3 months before I ended up in the hospital, I'd taken speech class, and the speech teacher on the first day of class walked in to class, and he said, "My name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic, and if any of you are having trouble with your drinking, call me at home." And then he went on to say, "My name is Rick, and I'm the professor of this class, and if you're having trouble with the class, call me at my office." And I did not write down that phone number, but the boyfriend that I'd almost killed just a couple days before was pretty good friends with the speech teacher, and he had the phone number. And on the way home, I was released from the hospital, and I was on my way back to college, and Joe was driving, and I said to him, I said, "I need to call Rick." And he goes, "Well, I already have." I go, "Oh." And what'd he say? He said, "Well, he told me he can't help me, but that if you want help, call me." And he gave me the phone number again. So I got back to school, and I called Rick. That was the first thing I did, was call this professor. And it was Monday afternoon, and here again, this is God doing for me what I cannot do for myself. So Monday afternoon, I call Rick, and he says, "Well, you're in luck. There's a meeting today. Meet me here." And so I met him there. And the meeting happened to be on the college campus where I was living. The meeting was organized by students at the college I was attending. And all of my excuses about being too young and not being like you people got thrown out the window from day one. I mean, that first meeting, I couldn't say I didn't identify with the people I met because they were all my age. And they were all in college. Well, two of them were in high school. But they were all in college. I mean, this one kid was 17 years old, he was still in high school, and he had 5 years of sobriety. So I couldn't really say at 21 that I was too young to be an alcoholic. So I went to that meeting, I have no idea what anybody said. I didn't say a word. And the women gave me their phone numbers, and I said, "Thank you very much." And this one woman came up to me, and she said, "Where do you live?" And I told her. And she said, "I'm picking you up tomorrow at 6:30. We're going to a meeting." And so I said, "Okay." So I was ready to go at 6:30. She picked me up that night. She goes, go to classes tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. Call me if you need to, but be ready at 6:30. I'll be at your house." She picked me up. We went to a meeting, and that was the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the meeting. I learned so much about how to live this program. It was a big book meeting. I don't think I ever shared in that meeting other than to say I was Ruth and I was an alcoholic. I mean, that meeting basically told me, the people in that meeting basically told me, "Sit down, shut up, and listen. You know nothing." And, you know. So I did. I got a donation. That was a Tuesday night. The next day was Wednesday, and it was September 17th. And this was a small town in Minnesota. There was two meetings a week, and I had already been to them. So on Wednesday, I was alone with me and these phone numbers of these people that I really didn't think wanted me to call them. And no tools to live sober, no tools to even get through an hour without drinking. And I went to class that day, and I was a mess that whole day. And I fought with myself all day. I was going to drink. No, I wasn't going to drink. I was going to drink. I wasn't going to drink. I didn't know how not to drink. But I knew I couldn't drink, and I didn't know what else to do. So I did the only thing I know how to do, which is got myself dressed up, and I walked to the bar. I thought I was walking to the bar. I planned to walk to the bar and get drunk. But that's not what God had planned for me. God, here again, was doing things, doing for me what I could not do for myself. I was walking in the opposite direction of every bar in that town, and I walked right into the path of this woman who picked me up the night before and took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Her name was Carol. She took me to her house. She sat with me the rest of the night. And I want to say that I lived in that town for 3.5 years by that time. I knew where every bar in that town was, and I knew how to get there, and I have no idea why I didn't get to the bar instead. I walked into the path of Carol, but that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. I was in self-will, but God still managed to prevent me from drinking that night. And so she sat up with me, and I don't know how long we sat up and talked, but she talked with me until the feeling had passed. And she said, "Do you think you can go home now and get some sleep?" And I said, "Yeah, I can probably go home now and get some sleep." And she said, "Okay, I want you to go home. I want you to go to bed. And tomorrow morning when you wake up, I want you to get on your knees and I want you to ask God to help you stay sober another day." And you know, this whole God thing for me, I had already had my exposure to God. I figured by this time He didn't want to have anything to do with me. And I had turned my back on the God I'd been raised with, but I did what she told me to do. And it was the first time in a long time that I had taken somebody else's advice and I did something somebody else's way. And I woke up that Thursday morning, and it was September 18th, and that is the reason why I consider that my sobriety date. It's because I willingly got up that morning, and the first thing I did was I got on my knees and I asked God to help me stay sober. And then I went to class. And then when I got home from class, I called Carol, and I went and hung out with her again. And I called her, and she said to me, "Okay, very good. I'm your sponsor now. And you've done the first 3 steps. So now you're on step 4. And we started working on step 4. And I did my 4th step with her, and I did my 3rd step with her, and my 5th step with Carol was pretty amazing. I was 21 years old, and you know, I told her, I ended up writing this 4th step, and I did it with the 4 columns, the way she the way the big book tells you to do it and everything. And I had a deadline. She told me we were gonna do the 5th step on this day, so I had to be done with my 4th step writing by that day. And I had wrote down everything. But as I was writing certain things, I was saying to myself, "I'm not going to tell her this. I'll write this down, but I'm not going to tell her this." And I had a number of those on my 4th step, these "I'm not going to tell her this." Well, she picked me up one day, and it was the day I was doing my 5th step, and we drove from the eastern border of Minnesota to the western border of Minnesota. We drove to South Dakota to an AA convention, and the whole time she was driving, I did my 5th step with her. And we got to the western border of Minnesota, and she pulled off into this park, and I finished telling her everything, and I really honestly had told her everything that was on that list, even the things that I didn't think I was going to tell her, I did tell her. And we're parked in this parking lot at this park, and she said, "Now get your big book and get out of the car."
So I did what she told me to do. I got out of the car and she said, go sit over there and, you know, by the lake and just read these pages in your big book and think about what you've just done and pray. And I'll stay right here. And so I said, okay. So I did. I got out of her car. I left my cigarettes, my purse, my money, my luggage for the weekend in her car. And I went and walked to the lake and she drove off. I left me there. And you know, it was the first time in my life that didn't frighten me. I was like so cleansed of everything that I had just dumped on her. And I had this complete trust that she wasn't going to lead me astray. And whatever, for whatever it was worth, I hadn't been drinking and I hadn't really thought about drinking. So, you know, I really wasn't worried. I knew somewhere in my heart that she was going to come back. And she thank God. So I went and I did my sixth and my seventh and my eighth step with her, and I started doing my amends. And I got to make my amends to my mom. That was probably the biggest amends I had to make. And I'm so grateful I got the opportunity to make that amends to her before she died. I made my amends to my father before he died. And I walked through the death of my mom and my dad sober, because this program and the steps and the principles of these steps and the guidance of my sponsors have enabled me to find a way to live life on life's terms without drinking. And so I've walked through that. You know, I was 21 when I got sober. I've walked through the death of my mom. I've walked through the death of my dad. And the reason I needed to make my ninth step amends is I had already planned that after I graduated from college, I was going to move to California. And my sponsor told me, you can move to California. You have to make your amends before you go. So you're not running from me. So I had to make all my amends, and I made my amends, and I moved to California. And the first night I was out here, I ended up at a meeting, and sober in small towns in Minnesota, okay? There were two meetings a week. So when I got to the San Fernando Valley, I had no idea what meetings were all about down there. They were completely different. This friend, I only knew one person that lived in California, and he hooked me up with somebody that was in recovery, and she was supposed to take me to meetings. First night I get here, she takes me to a Cocaine Anonymous meeting. I've never done cocaine. So, but anyway, ironically enough, that night, I met the man in this program who later became my husband. And so I was right where I was supposed to be, I just didn't know. The next night she took me to an Overeaters Anonymous meeting, and the next night she took me to I don't know what it was, a Gamblers Anonymous meeting. I don't know. It wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am an alcoholic, and I needed to get my ass to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I said to this woman, I said, do you ever go to AA? And she goes, no, they're too serious. They're not very much fun, and I kind of like the fellowship of the other programs, and it's all the same anyway. I said, no, I need to get to an AA meeting. And she goes, well, Rick goes to AA meetings. And I'll give you his phone number. And that's how Rick and I became friends, and eventually we became more than friends. And eventually we got married, and he was about a year sober when I met him, and I was 11 months sober when I met him, and we were friends for about 6, 7, 8 months before we became more than friends. And we ended up starting living the American dream. We had a child, we bought a house, we lived on the coast, life was going pretty good, and I was in a position where I was supposed to move to Visalia in order to keep my job, and we decided we weren't going to move to Visalia. We were not moving to Visalia. And one night my husband said, you know, if we moved to Visalia, we could do this, this, and this. And I thought, that makes sense, but I'm not moving to Visalia. And actually, okay, there again, God doing for me what I could not do for myself. I ended up moving to Visalia. And, you know, I'm so grateful that I did. Because some of those, this and this, that moving from the coast and moving to Visalia enabled us to do, was one of the things that enabled us to do was my husband was working out of town 3 days a week. He was leaving on Monday morning. He was working all day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And on Thursday night, he was driving back here to Visalia, or back to the coast. And so we weren't seeing each other Monday through Thursday. And we were terrified that one of us was going to lose our jobs, because if one of us lost our jobs, we were going to lose our house and, you know, the whole thing. We were living right at that point where any catastrophe could send us over the edge and we would lose it all. So we ended up, he ended up quitting his job, and we moved to Visalia and we sold our house on the coast. So we were able, he was able to, like, go to work for himself instead of work for somebody else. And it enabled him to spend 3 years with our son. The first 3 years I lived in Visalia, my husband and my husband, basically, I was the primary breadwinner, and he worked when he felt like it, but he spent 3 years with our son at a time when my son probably needed his dad more than he needed his mom anyway. And, you know, that was just a blessing for us, because what ended up happening, and I wasn't going to meetings at the time, I need to make that clear, I was not going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, but in September of 2006, we had lived here about 3 years, and on September 25th of 2006, my life took an unexpected turn. I woke up that morning, my husband told me he wasn't feeling well, he needed to go to the emergency room, but he asked me to take my son to school first, and I did. I took my husband to the emergency room, and I wasn't going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings at this time. I took my husband to the emergency room, and at some point it became clear that this could be really pretty serious. And I'm sitting there in this emergency room, and I don't know where this came from, other than it came from God. It was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. Because even though I wasn't going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I was still getting on my knees every morning and I was asking God for help. And I was getting on my knees every night and I was thanking Him for another day sober and thanking Him for the blessings of my life. So anyway, I was sitting there in the emergency room and I'm like, God, I don't know what's going on, but give us the strength to walk through this, whatever this is. And my husband ended up dying that day in the emergency room. And I once again had to walk through life on life's terms, and I wasn't thinking about drinking. It didn't occur to me to drink. And it occurred to me to drive my car off the overpass over there by the South Main Extension one day, but I didn't even try. But it did occur to me to do shit like that. It didn't occur to me to drink. But I was really messed up. Guy called me one day, his name was Sean G, and some of you might know who he is, he doesn't live around here anymore. His name is Sean G. He called me up one day, and that a couple of days later, and he said, let's breathe. And we knew him because his son and my son knew each other. They played sports together. So anyway, he called me and he said, look, Ruth, I know you're a recovering alcoholic, and I know that you're not going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, but I don't want you to drink over this. So will you go to a meeting with me? And I said yes. Program for grief counseling. I forego the grief counseling and I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor. I got active in this program again, and I started growing my relationship with my higher power and the effort I was putting into an Alcoholics Anonymous program. And you know, I managed to, I don't know, it's been only 8 years. It's been 7.5 years since my husband died. Living Alcoholics Anonymous to a level that I've never done before in my sobriety. And I have a stronger sobriety now than I did when I was, I hope, I think I have a stronger sobriety now than I did when I was in my first year of sobriety. But I tell you that because Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to live life on life's terms without altering my chemical makeup, without self-medicating in any way.
one guy that came up to me and said, he was a pharmacist in town, and he said, you know, I can get you whatever you need to sleep. And I'm like, thank you, but no, thank you. I knew I needed to do this, and I wasn't looking to change the way I felt about it. I was just looking for a way to walk through it. An Alcoholics Anonymous showed me how to walk through that. I ended up at the Tuesday Women's Amity meeting soon after that. And the women I met there carried me through for the next... Well, they're still carrying me through. Many of them are still carrying me through. And, I've learned a lot in the last 7 years about how to live life. This is the first time in my life I've ever lived single. And... or lived alone, and I'm living alone now. My son has since graduated from high school, and he's off doing some pretty amazing things for himself, and I'm really proud of him, and I had nothing to do with it. That was all God. I'm convinced that at this point in my life, I'm single for a reason, and that I'm not walking through this life alone, that God is with me, and I'm learning that is the one thing that I need to focus on, is growing that relationship and the rest of my relationship and work, and all of that all fall into place. If I am focused on just staying sober and perfecting and enlarging my spiritual condition, that the rest of the stuff falls into place. I've learned a lot of lessons about me and what I'm capable of doing. And some of the things that I've done in the last 7 years, I didn't even think I was capable of doing. And where did she go? Well, Diane actually taught me a lot of lessons about what I was capable of doing and held my hand and showed me how to do some things that I didn't think I was capable of doing by myself. Today I get up on my knees, or get up every morning and I meditate first. I start my day by listening. Decided that it's best for me to listen first and then talk. So I get up every morning and I meditate. Then I get on my knees and I ask God for help. And at night, I get on my knees and I thank God for another day sober. And then I meditate and I go to bed. And, whatever happens in between, it's all up to God. Sometimes it's not what I want. The script of where my life is not necessarily always the script I would have written for myself. But, I know God has great things planned for each and every one of us, and we just need to sometimes get out of His way, and that's not always easy for me to do. I'm so grateful for this program, and I'm grateful for the people that have brought me, that have carried me through some of this tough stuff, and I'm so grateful to have a relationship with a higher power. And I'm grateful for the life I have today. I'm really grateful for the life I have today. And if I continue to do those things,